Welcome to the Between the Lines podcast, a weekly literary author interview program produced by WABE Atlanta.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
It's been over 5 years since 9/11 and more than a year after Hurricane Katrina. So where do we stand today in terms of our capacity to respond to mega disasters? A recent report released by the Department of Homeland Security declared the U.S. unprepared for catastrophes of all sorts. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of Americans at Risk by Dr. Erwin Redlener, founder and director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness. His compelling book, Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now, reveals how our nation's current inability to plan for disasters is a problem, yet he does offer some solutions and recommendations. Thank you so much, sir, for allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
My pleasure to be here.
This is so important, Doctor, because I think it is important that we need to know much of what you're talking about here. Have we learned our lesson from 9/11 and Katrina? Have we heard the wake-up call, if you will?
Well, this is the odd thing about these really significant experiences that we've had with trauma and disaster over the last few years, Valerie, and that there certainly have been lessons. The question more is, have we learned those lessons? And I'm afraid to say we've heard them, we've reacted in a variety of ways, but unfortunately our progress, certainly since 9/11 and even since Katrina, in dealing with some of the issues that were so fateful and with such horrific consequences after those events, very, very little measurable results have so far made us more safe than we were around the time of those disasters. You know, people keep referring to them as wake-up calls, and one of the things I pointed out in my book, and it's like, you know, it's not really a wake-up call. It's more like a snooze alarm phenomenon where we get aroused by the disaster, we do some things, and then we sort of drift back off into complacency. And there are many examples of things that were dramatically problematic, let's say in 9/11, still unresolved.
So in a sense, we hear the message, but we don't really understand it, huh?
Yes, we don't quite understand it, and we don't seem to organize ourselves in order to fix them. And the example that was most painful to me, actually one of the things that prompted my writing the book, was the issue of radio communications among first responders, which seems like a relatively small point, but it is extremely emblematic. And you know that many firefighters lost their lives at Ground Zero on 9/11 simply because they weren't able to receive the radio warnings from the police department because they're on different frequencies and all kinds of communication problems. And that was tragic enough. But then I was down, and we were very involved in the relief efforts at 9/11. And then we went down again after Katrina to the Gulf. And in New Orleans, the same exact problems of difficulties in first responder agencies being able to communicate with one another. So it was 4 years afterwards. And this very basic problem that could be technologically fixed was simply not addressed yet. It's just hard to reconcile that.
Well, in your book, you speak to the fact that we have spent about $250 billion, meaning the federal government, on homeland security and disaster preparedness. What has it bought us?
Well, we've certainly bought things with the money. In some cases, though, programs were appropriated and the money not spent. But by and large, we've spent well over $200 billion, and we've bought programs, we've bought technologies that don't work, we've started programs that we haven't finished. Instead of getting a nice overview of what is needed to make the country more safe, safer in a major disaster, we've just purchased things for reasons that are not all that clear to people who have looked at this, and it's turned into more of a series of random purchases and acts of preparedness rather than any cohesive understanding of what we need to do to truly make the country more able to sustain and deal with a disaster, whether it's a natural event or an act of terrorism.
Your book focuses much on the issue of leadership. My husband used to always say, the speed of the boss is the speed of the crew. This is just not leadership from the White House, but it seems to me that it's you talk about a five-way partnership between five areas: the federal government, first responders, non-governmental agencies, for instance, the Red Cross, the private sector, and citizens.
Well, if you can imagine a large corporation with a number of divisions that has very defined goals, and so sales and marketing and research and development, and all of that has to be in sync in order for there to be cohesive progress for the entity, for the enterprise. Similarly, if we say our goal is to make the United States of America more prepared, either to prevent, minimize, or respond to disasters, then our divisions, our corporate division analogy would be those five sectors of society: government, the non-governmental agencies, the private sector, and individual citizens. And each of those has to be functioning to do its part, and then all of the parts have to be integrated. In order for that to happen, and it's very doable, so there's nothing all that mysterious about it, each of those sectors has to be contributing as effectively as possible its particular part of the preparedness agenda. And it does, unfortunately, start at the top, though, and we have a situation right now where there is no leadership in Congress that, in terms of appropriating money for various kinds of preparedness programs or Homeland Security, for that matter. The leadership from the White House and the various cabinet officers that are responsible for this has been shaky, to say the least. And on the other hand, we have citizens who, by and large, are not hearing or responding to the preparedness message. So we have a compound problem that is made complicated by the fact that none of the sectors are actually functioning optimally, and that leaves us in a very, very dicey situation with respect to the kind of progress we can make.
Thomas Friedman, I know he's, you know who that is, the Middle Eastern expert, New York Times columnist, and he's been a guest on the show, and he said that the failure to prevent 9/11 was not a failure of intelligence, but it was a failure of imagination.
Exactly. And actually, you know, not to get too far afield, but, you know, similarly, the problems in Iraq, you know, it's like we didn't seem to acknowledge whether you believe that we should have been in there in the first place or not. And obviously, I have great problems with that. But here you have a situation where, from a military point of view, a failure to imagine what actually would transpire after Americans, you know, invaded has been a major ongoing and growing problem. So we have to really figure out how, with these large-scale planning processes, we will invite imagination to sit in on all the discussions, because without it, we're going to have plans that won't make sense in the
Absolutely.
Real world.
Einstein has said that imagination is more important than knowledge.
I like that, and I agree with it.
There's a 9-point proposal in your book for how we can be better prepared.
It was very important that that the book concludes with some specific recommendations, but two kinds of recommendations: one for government, what it needs to do, and another for what citizens need to be aware of. And for the government-directed recommendations, let me just briefly run through these, because the first thing is that I think the 9/11 Commission, which just did such a tremendous job in defining what went wrong on 9/11 and making recommendations subsequently, should be reconvened as a permanent commission to oversee Homeland Security. And there's a lot of work that has to be done, and it needs an outside bipartisan body who can objectively assess what we're doing. So, for example, thinking about congressional accountability, we need to do something about the extraordinary number of committees and subcommittees that oversee some bitter piece of Homeland Security and preparedness. That needs to be consolidated, and that's one of the things the 9/11 Commission could work on. Secondly, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which had been a unbelievably successful agency during the 1990s in the Clinton administration, has been diluted, has been buried in the bureaucracy of the Department of Homeland Security, and they've been disempowered and deprofessionalized. That agency
What do you mean deprofessionalized?
Well, what happened was when Michael Brown, the former, you know, mm-hmm. horse show organizer, was hired with no experience to run the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Many, many of the senior professionals who had been around the agency for years left. They were demoralized. They didn't like the direction the agency was going in, and they were very dispirited that FEMA was now going to be absorbed into this new massive bureaucracy of Homeland Security. So a lot of people left, and that's what I mean by deprofessionalizing. And even though there's a very good guy now in place, David Paulison, running FEMA, it's going to take a long time to get that back in shape. But whatever happens, I do think it's critical that FEMA be extracted from Homeland Security and repositioned as an agency reporting directly. To the president in time of disasters. Third thing is that we have a real mess, and a dangerous one at that, in the health and public health systems. Ability to respond to major disasters. That definitely needs leadership. And I've recommended that the United States Surgeon General, the most respected, theoretically the most respected physician in the country, be asked to head the disaster planning response from the public health point of view and really create a public health czar. Fourth, we need to not only passively but very actively and legislatively require that the key agencies of, say, Homeland Security, FEMA, and Department of Health and Human Services are required by law to have people appointed to key positions who have the professional qualifications and experience to make that really work best. Because right now it's just up to, you know, whatever traditions that are there, and there's been an awful lot of cronyism in some of these appointments. Fifth is we've done very, very poorly in recent years in making sure that the military assets are integrated into our ability to respond to large-scale disasters.
What happened there this time? What happened with the military, you know, in Louisiana? I mean, we got over to the tsunami across the country in 2 days, but it was 5 days before we could get to New Orleans.
Yeah.
What happened?
And then finally when General Honoré came in, it was a whole new ball game. But that delay was very costly in terms of lives and chaos in New Orleans. And part of the problem is very inadequate pre-planning with the military, so people knew how they were going to work with the military and what the military had to offer, which is really a great deal. And then from a political point of view, the disorganization, the problems between a Democratic state government in Louisiana and the Republican administration in Washington may have been a factor. And finally, many of the most important military assets were not around. They're in Iraq and they're in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. First of all, I think the principle is that we really don't want, under normal circumstances, for the president, any president, to have the capacity to use U.S. military troops in a local community or in a state. So there are very explicit laws that say the governor of the state, under a national emergency or a state emergency, has to request. Now, those requests are almost always granted. But the process for the request, what are the objective criteria when they would request military assistance, let's say? None of this is very clear, so that we have the possibility of people actually waiting too long to even make that call to the White House. And that is exactly what happened after the flooding of New Orleans, just this long, long delay when obviously things weren't going well. This was a judgment call that turned out badly for the people of New Orleans.
Okay, let's move on to that.
So the next issue was, I really do think that one of the biggest Achilles heels, one of the biggest points of weakness in our preparedness capacity in the United States is a very, very dysfunctional healthcare and public health system. And I have provided a number of recommendations to what I call rapid fix the healthcare system so that we can respond to large-scale disasters. But right now, we have a real problem. For example, if we had a pandemic or any other kind of public health situation like bioterrorism, we are going to be in big trouble because our healthcare system is not working properly.
That kind of goes to a very serious issue, which is the crumbling infrastructure in this city, I mean, in this country, of so many things, our transportation systems and everything from sewer lines to railroads. And there, it, it, It's going to take money, lots and lots and billions and billions of dollars. Lots of money,
exactly yeah. Right, Valerie.
Every time we raise the issue of increased taxes or, you know, where we have to make sacrifices, it doesn't look like we're ready to go there, that we're willing to make the sacrifice. How can we, I don't know, how are we going to pay for this?
Well, here's the thing, you know, and it is a lot of money. There's no question about it. And this is really my seventh recommendation that we create this new Millennium Infrastructure Initiative. The fact is that most of our key infrastructure, from our bridges and tunnels to a lot of our industrial facilities to the interstate highway system in the United States, are 50 years old or more.
Mm-hmm.
They are just wear and tear, very fragile right now. The American Society of Civil Engineers says it'll take about a trillion and a half dollars to fix this. Well, if we're serious about trying to make the country more secure, less vulnerable, then I think this is not, we don't have to make this investment in 1 year. It could be a 10 or 15 year project, but we do have to address this. And if you think about it, we're spending at least that much money on an annual basis in terms of what it would cost us to do the infrastructure in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. And I think we owe it to the American people to fix this infrastructure, to make the investment. And think about how many jobs this would create, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
A tremendously stabilizing economic initiative that would at the same time fix our bridges, tunnels, and highways.
Well, if you've just tuned in, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going between the lines of Americans at Risk: Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now, by Dr. Erwin Redlener. You're so true about the impact on the economy, because you'd have to hire engineers, construction workers, you know, thousands of service people to make these corrections, which would be a boost to the economy. So often we just can only see what's happening today or tomorrow, and we can't see down the road a few years and realize that, what is that old Ben Franklin term, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Pound of cure. You know, it's like, it's interesting you bring that point up, because as a physician, we have this all the time. You know, it's like it's difficult to make people grapple with the actual issues of prevention. So see, you know, how hard it is to get people to stop smoking, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We really react to the acute problem when we have lung cancer, and we got to do dramatic things, and so very often not successful. The simpler but far less dramatic thing is not to smoke in the first place, and just really hard to get those messages to sink in sufficiently.
Well, there are two more items to strengthen the industries with respect to regulations,
yeah.
And then I want to talk in length about that last one a little bit. But let's talk about the industries.
Just to worry, yeah, about. There are several industries which pose significant threats to large numbers of people in the United States, either from just an industrial accident or from terrorism. So the two that come to mind most immediately are the chemical industry and nuclear industries. So those two represent the two most susceptible to calamity industries in the United States, and neither of those are sufficiently protected or secure. So in terms of easy access into chemical plants, that has become now a well-known situation around the United States. But even the transport of highly toxic chemicals by train, for instance, and I'm thinking about chlorine gas in large tankers, many of these train routes go directly through large urban areas, and that should be something that's dealt with almost immediately. And we have people working on that, but it's slow going.
Which brings us really kind of like to the final point of upgrading and engaging the citizen participation. Let's speak about how important that is.
Let me put it this way. There's nothing that government can do, even if it did every single thing that I and others have recommended. There's nothing that would replace the necessity for individual citizens and families and local communities to get themselves prepared. This is the true crux of the partnership. You know, that we talked about the five sectors that need to be involved, but the main partners are government and the citizens. And so we feel strongly that it is important that people understand what they need to do as individuals to make themselves and their families safer. And there's been a lot of information around there and messages about making a kit that you can that will have food and water and battery-operated radio, et cetera. And you want to keep a kit in the car, a kit at work, and then stockpile 3 days of food and water and other supplies at home. And all of that is out there, but it's not being very well absorbed. Our latest survey, taken this summer, in fact, showed that still no more than a third of Americans have done much of anything to actually prepare for a major disaster. There are some other things that people don't think about very often when it comes to this, and one of them that I talk about in the book is staying healthy and fit. And I know this sounds like another commercial for, you know, healthy lifestyle, but if you look at what has to happen to prepare for, say, a hurricane in the southeast United States, and boarding up windows and organizing things and making your house safe, people need to be fit. And even those very, very terrifying circumstances where people were in, flooded out in New Orleans in their attics and they had to punch their way out of through the roof to save themselves requires a certain level of physical capacity there. You may have to be moving quickly to get away from something that's dangerous. So staying fit is important. Keeping your mind in a place where you can function and think during a disaster is something that comes from practice, and that practice means talking about emergency plans with your family, potentially joining local groups. There are government-funded entities called Citizen Emergency Response Teams, or CERTs, that will help people become familiar with what has to happen in a disaster.
I think that's good. I think this is very, very important here, that the state of mind, the readiness, and the state of mind of our citizens. I don't want to go over this too lightly, because everything is determined by our attitude and our approach.
No question about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we
talk
about
one of the reasons.
The resilience is necessary. Go ahead.
Exactly. This issue of being resilient, meaning that you have the mental toughness or capacity to think and behave in ways that will be life-saving in the event of an emergency. This is very, very important. It's important that your children be resilient in general as they're growing up. Mm-hmm. And it's important that families think about the resiliency issues themselves, because no matter what happens, whether it's somebody in a local small situation, a car wreck, for example, we need to be able to have our citizens be able to function appropriately. It's one of the reasons that I'm recommending first aid and CPR for virtually everybody, because it helps give you confidence that if something were to happen, you know what to do. This issue of not knowing what to do, on the other hand, can be a real deterrent to effective action. And, of course, that's something that we'd like to try to avoid in a crisis.
And if they don't read your book, what they can do is to contact the American Red Cross or go online or things like that. There are many sources out there that can give us suggestions. Interesting, too, though, there were a couple of other things you mentioned about our country being in a state of readiness. You encouraged young people, high school, college kids, to learn an Arab language.
You know, right, in the big picture in this world, the problems that we're now seeing are, in my view, not going to be resolved militarily. There may be things that we have to do militarily, and we, you know, there are things that we just have to confront as a grown-up society. But at the end of the day, the real hope for the world is understanding and connections and communication. So on one level, being able to speak the language of other societies and cultures is critically important. But even from the most practical point of view, if you look at our intelligence agencies now, there is an unbelievable shortage of individuals with the kind of language and cultural background to allow us even to interpret and translate all the documents that are out there that we need to be paying attention to. So, and I've actually spoken about this with my own children, that it's something to think about, that there's real national need for people to be involved in these fields.
As president and co-founder of the Children's Health Fund, I know that you are very, very concerned about the issue and the impact on children of these mega disasters. Quickly, let's talk about why children might need a different approach than adults.
People who are planning for emergencies often just do it in generalities, so without really thinking about the specific needs of people who have either special health needs or in age groups where other considerations need to be in place. For children in particular, they are not just little adults medically. There are many things about kids that make them much more susceptible to all kinds of issues, whether it's pandemic influenza or if it's a bioterrorism attack. There are very special medical needs that need to be understood and addressed in the planning process. The medications that we might use for antidotes to everything from anthrax to other kinds of bioterror agents are different for children. So it is very important that we incorporate and understand these needs as we are making our big disaster plans. If we don't, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where our children are disproportionately vulnerable and harmed by whatever the event, and something I'm sure all of us want to avoid.
Well, I think you kind of put it quite appropriately when you said in your book, the cavalry is not coming. That means we're going to have to do what?
Well, this is a very important point here, and that is that the question is, who are the first responders? And if people think that they're going to be able to call 911, if they could even get a dial tone,
right,
after an major emergency, and then have some kind of first responder agency showing up right away, that is a delusion, and we really have to understand that. Because the reality is, Valerie, that we are ourselves, the citizens, the true first responders in a large disaster. And the bigger the disaster, the longer it's going to take for help to get to you. So knowing that you're the first responder should be a powerful motivator to have you get ready, have you learn what you need to do, and get that information soon, practice it, and accept the fact that from a mental readiness point of view, your role as a first responder can be absolutely critical in saving your life and the lives of your family.
Thank you so much, Dr. Redliner. You have been so helpful. The book is Americans at Risk, Why We Are Not Prepared for Mega Disasters and What We Can Do Now. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us today.
Pleasure. And if people, when they finish reading the book, they could send it to their congressman. That would be a good idea.
Great. Thanks.
Thank
again.
You, Valerie.
That's it for this week. Until next week, I'm Valerie Jackson, reminding you that there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or participate in the online book club. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Dave Barraswain. Technical producer, Ken Murray. Production assistant, Chichi Morka. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Funding for this program is provided, in part, by the UPS Foundation and the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, under the guidance of the Fulton County Arts Council and the Georgia Council for the Arts. Between the Lines is a production of WABE.